We're continuing now, and Jim, I want to ask, at what point did you separate then from AFTAC? You had been with them since 1958. How did it come about that you went somewhere else?
Selfishness.
Oh, I can't believe it. True? Is it true?
True.
Okay.
In my questionnaire, I mentioned to you that my son was graduating from college. I'll rephrase it, in his senior year. My daughter was in senior year in high school. I didn't want to move, and I was subject to moving because I'd been there over 3 years.
Okay.
And that was one reason. I didn't want to move then.
Mm-hmm.
The second reason was I'd been a lieutenant colonel for 10 years, promoted way ahead of schedule.
Yeah.
And the primary zone for colonel came in, for me, came in 1967, and I didn't make it. And I was very, very shook up and disappointed. And so when, no, wait a minute, 1968, not 67.
68, okay.
That's when I first came in the primary zone. So my boss came to me and says, "Jim, I got some bad news. You weren't on the colonel's list." He got a list of before it was let out to him. He says, "I have gone over all of your ERs. I've examined every word to see if just one word might have tainted him in the promotion board's decision." He said, "I don't know what he didn't make it." I said, "Well, I think I do." I said, "On the chart, personnel center, there's a little blank up there where it says Vietnam."
Yeah.
And I said, "I can do something about that. I can volunteer to move to Vietnam, and maybe, just maybe, I might make colonel." So I went home, talked to Minnie Mae, and I said, "Here's the situation. I can volunteer for some positions that I know in Vietnam through a friend of mine in the Lieutenant Colonel branch, not Lieutenant Colonel branch, but promotion,
mm-hmm.
not the promotion branch, the personnel branch in San Antonio at Randolph."
So you had some information about what might be possible for you in Vietnam. Uh-huh.
So I talked to her, and we talked about my future career and all, if I didn't make it, and the impact it would have on us, retirement, everything. The
sure.
impact, her being there, the mom and the papa of the kids, and getting them through college and finish high school. So that was agreed, and I volunteered, and I was accepted into Task Force Alpha. I didn't know what Task Force Alpha was. I was accepted an assignment to Vietnam, and then got assigned to it. So I left, and in November 1968, and she became mom and papa, did a great job.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll get to the assignment in a minute, but during that tour, in June 69, I was fortunate enough to have my R&R, rest and recuperation, and come back to the States and see my pin my son's gold bars on him, and see him graduate, see my daughter graduate, and go back. I'm sorry, that was not R&R, that was leave.
That was leave? Okay.
Leave. Yeah.
And then, let's see, I guess it was before then, in July, I went back then to a base.
Yeah.
And I had a great commander there.
There being NKP, right?
Oh, wait a minute. This didn't happen to NKP, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was your first tour there.
That first tour. I came back from NKP on R&R. I was getting this mixed up.
That's okay. Yeah.
I came back R&R and then went back to NKP and did my job at Task Force Alpha there. And
Jim, let me ask how much you had been paying attention to what was happening in Vietnam during the time you were in Sacramento during the big build-up, and of course you had a completely different mission supporting the radiological and intelligence effort of the Air Force. But what were you thinking as you were observing the huge build-up in Vietnam, aside from how it might impact your own career, which you've discussed a little bit?
I didn't know whether I'd be sent over there or not, honestly. Uh-huh. I didn't know I really didn't suspect I would be, and the reason being, I can go into more detail after we get the NKP.
Sure.
If you'd rather, I can do it right now.
Why don't we do it now while you're thinking about it? Right?
All right. When I left NKP, or I'll rephrase, before I left NKP, I made colonel in late 1959. And when you make colonel, you have a separate branch for assignments from the normal personnel system.
Okay.
It's in the Pentagon.
Okay.
And I got a TWX. I'm getting close to rotation now. For my rotation date, preparing for my next assignment, right, out of NKP. I got a twix that says, how would you, or would you agree to be the air mission, the chief of air mission at Managua, Nicaragua? Hmm. And I twixed back and says, hey guys, I'm just finishing overseas tour in Vietnam. I don't overseas again right away.
Mm-hmm.
So, I didn't go. But when it came time for me to rotate, before I got time to rotate, I had orders to report to England Air Force Base as a deputy base commander.
Mm-hmm.
And then the commander left and I became commander.
Commander, right.
And I hadn't been there 6 months when a Colonel Simon's branch calls and says, hey, how would you like to be the air attaché in Israel? Now, this is why I don't think I would have gone to Vietnam from AFTAC, because by some way I was tagged in the so-called, quote, diplomatic corps.
Mm-hmm. So you had all this experience.
How would you like to be the air attaché in Israel? Hmm. And I said, hey, guys, I just told you. And I didn't want to go to Managua. Mm-hmm. Okay, so about 3 or 4 weeks, a month later, how would you like to be assistant air attaché in Moscow?
Hmm.
Hey guys, how would you like to be air attaché in
Ethiopia?
Ethiopia.
Yeah. That Minnie Mae is like, I don't think so.
So I came home and told Minnie Mae, I said, gal, I said, you know, they've asked me, how would you like? They're going to come in here one of these days after I've been here about a year, maybe a little over, and say, here you go, or retire. After you get to be over 20 something years, they can say, no, if you don't accept your retirement as a colonel, they can say you're retired. So I said, how about if I volunteer for 2 real safe Vietnam jobs that I know of? And she said, what do I do? Well, our son was in the Army going to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Our daughter was in the university in Louisiana. And I was getting ready to move to the University of Texas at Austin. So
I lived on the base.
Yeah, we lived on the base.
Oh, okay. You were living there. Okay.
Yeah. He was base commander.
At England.
On the base. At England. Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. So I said, you know, your mother is getting ready to move from Irving to Glenrose, Texas, which is down southwest Fort Worth. And she might need a little bit of help. Mm-hmm. And it'd give you a year of just being with your mother, just the two of you.
Yeah.
And they both idolize each other.
What a
and
great,
she says, you know,
great opportunity.
I'll think about this. So she okayed it. So I called Colonel's branch and I says, okay, guys.
I got Minnie Mae's okay. I'm ready to go.
Yeah. I want to either be the commander of a fat group out of Saigon, I forgot the number of it right now,
mm-hmm,
or I want to go to AVCCC as either the operations officer or as an orbit commander. Hey, we don't get many of these requests. Stand by, we'll be back.
Mm-hmm.
A week later, I'm on list to go to Karat.
Back to
Thailand. To Udorn.
To Thailand.
ABCCC. So that's...
So it's really...
I took the little dog and went home to Mama.
That's the answer to your question of why I didn't think I would go to Vietnam, because I was apparently tagged to be in a diplomatic corps somewhere. With my experience.
Absolutely. With how much work you had done internationally, it completely makes sense. Well, describe, Jim, if you can, Task Force Alpha. This was your first tour, and your base at NKP.
To get to Task Force Alpha, to get to any assignment in Vietnam, you had to go through what they call snake school in the Philippines. I determined it was not a snake school, it was a rat school. In 2 weeks, so I had to report to Clark Air Base en route to NKP and survive and being taught how to escape and evade and survive if I get shot down or whatever.
Now, how many other colonels or lieutenant colonels at this point were there in the snake school?
Gosh, I don't know.
A few?
Well, there were probably half a dozen.
Not many.
Not many. Because, and I wouldn't even go into a flying job.
Right.
Except,
Well, you did fly a little, as I understand it.
But I wasn't supposed to. It was illegal. Because I wasn't supposed to fly over enemy territory or be any enemy territory for 1 year after I left AFTAC.
Ah, because of the... Can you go ahead and say why?
Yeah.
Just to clarify, why would that be?
I'll have to regress backwards.
That's okay.
Example station, because any airplane that flies over a communist country is subject to engine trouble, having to land inadvertently. And here I am, my name on the roster up in Moscow. Don't let him go. We won't interview him.
Mm-hmm.
That type of thing. Mm-hmm. And a perfect example of how inconvenient this was when we were stationed in Wiesbaden. If I wanted to go to Ankara, Turkey, as an example, Pan Am 1 flew direct from Wiesbaden to Istanbul over Bulgaria.
But
I couldn't fly Pan Am 1 because you might have to abort and land in Bulgaria, a communist country.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to fly to Switzerland, get on Swiss Air to Athens, get on Greek Air, whatever it's called,
mm-hmm.
fly around to Istanbul, get on Turkish Airways, Istanbul to Ankara.
And this restriction survived your appointment at AFTAC for 1 year only?
No.
Or how long?
I couldn't do that for a full year after
that. For a year after.
The whole time I was in AFTAC.
But yes, that was standard operating. Yeah. You could not fly over communist country.
And it got kind of touchy down occasionally in some areas of Africa.
Right.
They weren't communist.
Right. But they weren't exactly friendly.
That's right. So you had to be real careful. But of course, we didn't have detachments, but I just couldn't fly over. Had to pick an airline, might go way around.
Okay.
Well, now back to
that
was illegal for me to go to fly the missions I did out of NKP.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to finish snake school. At snake school, they put you in, they give you academics first,
uh-huh.
teach you how to escape and evade, survive off the land for a temporary time.
Uh-huh.
And then if you get caught, here's what you do. You don't tell them anything. Be nice to them. But take whatever they give you. Whatever they torture they do or whatever.
Just take it.
Yeah, take it. Yeah.
And what was the limit of what you were supposed to give back? Literally, was it name, rank, and serial number?
Name, rank, that's it.
And that's it?
That's it.
Okay, that's not just a movie thing. That's mm-hmm. for real.
That's a real thing.
Okay.
And then they put you out in the field. And I've forgotten the name of the tribe, the Philippine tribe that they contracted with to try to catch us.
Yeah.
It was all at night. We'd go out three different nights. We had to go out and try to camouflage ourselves all night long. so that one of these guys couldn't catch us. They were on throughout. They got paid if they caught us. We had three little chips like a poker chip. And if one of them caught us, we'd give it to him. And we could stay there or we could move and hide again. Mm-hmm. But he'd go to his buddy and say, "Hey, I got my chip. You go. He's over here somewhere. Go close." If you gave three chips away, you failed the course.
And your chip was worth something to them? What
it's
could
worth,
they do
worth
with it?
Something amount of money, and I don't know what it was.
Cash or food or something?
Cash.
Yeah, okay.
Cash.
Okay.
At least that's what we were told.
Mm-hmm.
So I got caught once, and that was all. But I gave a guy a chip, and he patted me on the shoulder. "No problem, sir. No problem, sir."
At least he was gracious about it.
Yeah, anyway, I finished snake school, rat school, and went on to NKP and reported in, and General John Dice was the commander of Task Force Alpha.
Mm-hmm.
Had a big compound on the air base there, and only the military assigned there. We had some Navy, mostly Air Force, we had a few Army, and some IBM contractors, civilian contractors, all lived on the base. And in the compound, we had the largest IBM computer complex in Southeast Asia, including 7th Air Force down in Saigon. And we were to monitor what was happening along the Ho Chi Minh Trail and implant sensors wherever we could to try to determine their movement and the facts on basic NKP. We had a big special operations squadron there and had to serve the facts in the FAC group flew several different type airplanes, and the facts would tell us of various movements. But they basically, their mission, as you know from Richard, their mission was to spot and then call in the strike forces to strike. And if they saw something that the strike forces couldn't get to or didn't get to, then they would notify us, and we'd get a sensor. If we didn't have sensors in the general area, put sensors there. If we found that there might be a truck park, well, let me regress. The North Vietnamese would come out north of the DMZ through the mountain range that separated Laos from Vietnam. And McGee Pass was a big one, and there's one just north of McGee Pass. Oh gosh, this map is so complicated. McGee Pass is somewhere about.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the DMZ?
Yes, it is.
About right there at McGee Pass, and that other one, right over here somewhere.
Uh-huh.
So the Ho Chi Minh Trail actually started here in a minor scale, not near the majors coming through McGee Pass. You know, about here. Did I send you a copy of some maps?
Yes, you did.
Documented on there.
Absolutely, and these will be included in the collection.
The passes are documented
mm-hmm.
on there,
mm-hmm.
and I doctored the maps to show generally what we were doing.
And did you make the markings on these maps yourself?
I made the markings.
Okay. Let's see. I'm just.
Gosh, you got some black ones. I have some colored ones.
I made a copy of this.
Okay.
This is a copy for me.
This is the second tour.
Second tour. See, where's my map of the first?
The first tour.
There we go. And this is the map that's been deposited in the Jim Hall collection mm-hmm. entitled Sensor Patterns.
Well, then, up here.
A little further north
than
Bing.
Uh-huh. I don't know. Well, it wasn't. It wasn't noted on this map.
Uh-huh.
This was.
Here are the passes.
When I stole.
Borrowed
the copyright.
Mm-hmm.
It burned the copy.
Mm-hmm.
This was all this was on here.
Okay, sure.
This type printing I put
did
on there
this.
Myself.
Okay. Uh-huh.
But they would come through this pass up here in a minor scale,
uh-huh.
and then come through. Wait a minute.
This is
McGee and Bankrai.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm sorry. There they are. That's the two.
Mm-hmm.
Bankrai here and McGee here. This was a minor of the two. This was a major of the two.
Okay.
And what we After we got word from the facts, if they needed some implementation of sensors to help them, we would implant the sensors, have either the C-130 group out of Da Nang, I think it was, implant the sensors, or the F-4 group at Ubon.
Ubon.
Down south of somewhere, Ubon, right there. Go plant them. And then we got the idea that in addition to truck parks and all that had been being used, we got the idea to plant them along what we thought was the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And we would hear them. Well, now I'll regress. How these sensors were both acoustic and seismic. And we had C-121, we didn't, but there was C-121 circling stationed at Karat from another organization, stationed to 24-hour circling over somewhere about the northern part, northeastern part of Thailand. And they would, these sensors would communicate their data back to them.
So they're transmitting.
Transmitting.
They're both sensing and transmitting.
Sensing and transmitting. Mm-hmm. Coming back into our computer center. And the sensors were approximately 2 feet long. You may have one in your finger.
I don't know that we do, actually. I don't think so.
Well, I drew you a little picture.
Yes, I saw the picture here.
One looked. I don't remember exactly.
So about 2 feet.
About 2 feet. Uh-huh. Something like that. And then this plate right here to keep it from sinking into the ground.
Right.
It was sink right up to this right
about how
here.
Big around would that plate be?
No, about 16, 18 inches.
Okay,
And then with a foliage.
Fake
foliage with antennas in it. And the antennas were much different than this. It'd stretch out or whatever, but on my drawing there, just drew that way.
Okay.
And these sensors, both some of the these were better for seismic. We also had some that we could hang in trees. It would pick up the acoustic. But this also had an acoustic capability, a minor, less capable than the tree hangers. But it could have acoustic. So when we then decided to start putting them along what we thought was a trail, we would have these implanted there and there and there and there and so forth. This is not near the scale.
Sure.
And then when these would start transmitting, the trucks were coming through this section and got to this section. We knew how many hours or minutes or whatever that took. And we knew how the distance from here to the next one.
So you'd be tracking the duration.
So, that's right. Mm-hmm. So shortly after the first one, and we knew their speed, we would contact the fighter bombers, the F-4s, out of Ubon, and say, here's where they're going to be at such and such a time, go get them. And when we heard them coming through that particular group of sensors, we could hear the bombs going off, and then everything got silent, so we knew that we did a good job on whatever number of trucks were there. And this was mostly at night, all the time at night. In the daytime, the foliage there, the trees, the jungles there, the trees had three different areas of vegetation. The tall spout trunk, and in a lower vegetation area, middle vegetation area, and upper vegetation area. And that's why they went in there with Agent Orange. Never was involved in anything associated with that. But that's what they're trying to do, defoliate that.
Yeah.
So that we could see
what was happening on the ground.
Under the jungle. So that's that was our mission, was to try to kill as many trucks, as many, any kind of vehicle. Even guys on bicycles.
These sensors then were acute enough, sensitive enough to pick up the movements of bicycles, foot traffic?
Mm-hmm. Foot traffic.
Animals.
Because.
Wow.
Yeah. The animals, elephants.
Do you know where these were? Were these a U.S. Air Force design, or were they a contractor, or do you know anything about that?
I don't know.
End of it?
I don't know.
Okay. And manufacturer? Who built these puppies?
I don't know.
No idea.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I'm just wondering. I mean, the sensors are really interesting. They were seated along particular routes. How did you know where they need to be placed?
Basically by the facts telling us. I forgot. No, there's another group. We had a special operations unit that would be let down into Vietnam by helicopter.
Okay.
Like we talked about it, heard about it in Afghanistan.
Sure.
And they would tromp all through this area down here and report back by radio.
Where the
routes
were.
Here's where they are. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then the facts would tell us that it looks like trails here, trails there, no movement today, but trails.
Okay. And these the sensors and transmitters were clearly powerful enough to get that signal all the way to aircraft then circling over Thai territory, not over Laotian territory.
It could be over Laotian.
It might
have spread over out over Laos.
How long would the sensor be active? Was it run on a battery?
It was battery powered. So, okay. You know, I don't really remember. All I ever saw of a sensor was a display there in our compound.
Mm-hmm.
The sensors were all down at Ubon or where the drop, the C-130s were. I think they were out of Da Nang. I might be mistaken.
Now, Jim, your title, I know your rank, but your title when you were at NKP was what?
When I first got there, I was Deputy Director of Operations. And then the operations officer was transferred, rotated back to the States, and I became the director of operations.
Now,
as a lieutenant colonel.
And your work was to get the aircraft?
The work was to, yes, to coordinate with the units that we would employ to do both jobs, to do the planning, and to do the destruction. And also, we relied on the facts so much that I flew with the facts as a co-pilot just to understand what their mission was and how they accomplished it. And then I take that back and massage that a little bit, say, how can we employ this for our mission in addition to what they're doing, just spotting something and calling in the firepower on their own.
The aircraft that the facts were flying were what? What type of aircraft?
Oh, it varied. They were small. I think the largest one was a Cessna. I don't remember the numbers.
Uh-huh.
Had both a pusher and a puller propeller.
Okay.
One front and one back.
Right.
Twin tails. And two passengers.
Co-pilot?
Well, no co-pilot.
Oh, okay.
He was by himself unless someone rode with him.
Like you?
Like me.
Okay.
The others were smaller than that, and I don't remember the numbers of them. 01, 02.
That sounds right.
I'm not sure.
02.
I could look it up in my records, but I don't. And in addition, the special operations group there flew the A-1s that I mentioned earlier.
Yes.
And they flew the A-20s. I think they call them B-26s then, but they were,
mm-hmm.
Or maybe they were modified earlier B-20s. World War II airplanes anyway. Anyway, they were B-26s in Vietnam. And I flew co-pilot on both of those. I didn't fly co-pilot on A-1. I flew back seat on it with the wing commander of that outfit, just to see how they operated in helping the facts.
Exactly.
Strike
right. How to coordinating all that. Now, go ahead, Jim.
In the B-26, this was a nighttime operation only,
mm-hmm.
And because they had night vision. And I don't know why the others didn't. Well, a small airplane didn't fly at night. But the A-26s did, B-26s did. And I flew co-pilot with one of my good buddies from AFTAC, who happened to be there.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So another AFTAC veteran out there in town.
There's still another one later.
But okay.
But we, this IBM computer setup would take all this information, process it, and then put it out to the desks of our operation people. And then we had to report, in addition to planning for what we're going to do, report to 7th Air Force at Saigon and at Tansanute. Here is what's happening. Here's our plan. And we request permission to strike. And if there wasn't time to strike, we had okay to go on our own if it was a real hot one and it might disappear.
So you did have a priority clearance to go ahead and launch an operation?
At uncertain conditions.
Wow. And those conditions were?
Just if it was an emergency and the attack might disappear, the attack capability might disappear.
And you were the one giving that order, making that decision?
Yeah. Well, with general approving it.
Sure, and you have staff below you who are also helping you get all the data together. How big a staff did you have?
Oh, I had, we had two sections. We had the operations staff and the technical staff. 15 technical, about 23, 25, about 8 or 10 operational staff. And, oh, wait a minute. In the IBM room, we had 30 people.
Tell her how big the computer was.
Yeah.
Well,
you mentioned that it was the biggest IBM station.
It was. I can't give you a size. Take a room roughly 40 by 40. And like your cabinets upstairs.
Right.
That's the way the computers were in those days.
Is that right?
This room just solid with cabinets like that that you can get on laptop today.
That's right.
I just didn't know you'd already told them.
Now, was that, were they using at any point in their system those famous punch cards? Was there any punch card technology there? We're beyond that now. Did tapes? Tapes. Wow. And IBM contractors, so civilian contractors operating this whole thing.
Yeah.
And did they report to you?
No. They reported directly to the general.
Okay. And what was the... Was this General Dyers that you mentioned?
D-Y-A-S. Dyers.
Oh, D-Y-A-S. Okay. What was his background? Was he...
I don't really know. Wait a minute. He was a TAC man. He was a fighter pilot before he came there.
Fighter pilot even as far back maybe as World War II?
Was he that old? Could have been. At least Korea.
Okay.
But maybe World War II. I really don't know.
Okay.
But he and I became close friends.
You got along with him too?
He told me one day, he said, Jim, I've been in the Air Force a long time. And he said, I've been in TAC practically all my career. And you know more than any colonel I've ever seen do.
That was a good point.
That was pretty nice.
And he's the one that pinned my eagles on me.
Oh,
when the orders finally came
through. Okay, well, he sounds like a good guy.
I knew he was a colonel.
But then, we got him home.
Oh, you did? How did you find out?
His boss there in Sacramento, and his wife are our good friends. And one evening, the kids and I were staying in Sacramento that year. He came over. I just thought it was a visit.
Sure.
He brought me a big, long stem red rose, and I didn't know why. I took it, and on one of the little leaves was some eagle,
insignia.
He had put it onto the leaf?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
I didn't even know yet.
Oh, boy. Now, were you able to communicate very much?
Letters.
Letters only.
Did you ever call? Did you ever get on a Mars line?
No way to get a call.
No way, huh?
No. There was no long distance capability for NKP. There might have been in country down to Bangkok, but that town was away from us. No.
Yeah, and NKP sits right up on the border.
Yeah.
It
is. It's just right on the Mekong River right there.
Mm-hmm.
And the little town is a nothing town.
I'll bet.
However, I did get a wonderful pair of shoes made there for $7.50.
Did you? How'd you manage that?
Well,
there was a local
occasion. Grow around your foot.
Hey, take a big ledger and spread it out. And you put your feet on there, and he draws around your foot. First of all, he gives you catalogs. He says, what type you want.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And he draws around your foot, and then he puts a tape around your instep, and that's all. You go back 3 or 4 days later, you got a pair of shoes that just fit
custom.
Better than any you buy on.
Custom. How long did you wear those?
Well, I still have a pair. I have worn them in several years.
But
let's see. I lived in Granbury, I was retired in 1975,
mm-hmm.
and I was still wearing them when I retired, and that's from 68
wow.
to 69.
Wow. Now, did you get across the border into Laos much?
Not from that tour.
Not on
the
this
other tour.
Okay.
I flew with the facts over
right.
into there, but never crossed.
But you weren't on the ground. Okay. And is this the time when Minnie Mae came over and you guys had a
no,
some time?
That was second.
That was second tour as well? Okay.
But in addition to all of that, when I might have mentioned earlier, I don't know, but I went down to base operations one day
uh-huh.
and told the guys, hey guys, I'm in a non-flying job over here in Task Force Alpha. I have a pair of wings. What do you have out here I can fly? They said, two old Goony Birds. C-47s, if you don't know what a Goony Bird is.
C-47, wow.
And they said, do you have any time a Goony Bird? Well, yeah, from Kirtland Air Force Base, and then we talked about 300 hours. Well, let's go out there and run around a pattern one time, and you'll be checked out, and you can fly Goony Birds when you have time. So, they'd have missions down into South Vietnam, as far as Saigon, frequently into Da Nang and Chu Lai here,
mm-hmm.
and I'd come from NKP across Laos, down in there, get small ground fire, both on takeoffs and landings over here,
mm-hmm.
just locals, and then take people down to Saigon to 7th Air Force headquarters and that type of thing. And then we also had the base had a program where once every week in, they would send a C-47 to Chiang Mai, which is way over in
mm-hmm.
the
northeast.
Yeah, uh-huh. Northwest.
Northwest, I'm sorry, you're right.
Way up near the Burma border, somewhere right in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a beautiful cultural city, the former old capital of Thailand, and stayed that way. But they were beginning to modernize when I was going there. Some weekends I would have a weekend off and I'd fly up there. And I became acquainted. Wait, you did come.
I came there.
Yeah.
You were up in Chiang Mai at some point?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So.
Just visiting.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I made a good friend of a teak furniture manufacturer uh-huh. there who had a friend who was a taxi driver. And I would always call my teak friend and say, Tony, American name, Tony, can you get hold of John, see if he's available for the weekend, if I was going to go up there.
Right.
And I just hire him for the full weekend, take me out in the boondocks, their little communities and all, explain to me what they were doing.
On?
This is way off.
Well, but warfare. did you get a good feeling for the Thai people up in that area?
I love the Thai people. They're the most humble people I've ever known.
Did you
probably realize that here?
Yeah, I've had some Thai friends too. That sounds very much right. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Sounds very much right to me. Did you, while you were at NKP and in your position as director of operations, have any interface with Thai officials or Royal Thai Air Force people?
Not at NKP. The general did, and the wing commander did.
Okay.
With the Thai base commander.
The base commander.
We were on a Royal Thai base,
mm-hmm.
and they ruled the base. But they were it was wide open for us
sure.
to do anything we needed to do.
Sure.
No complications, whatever. But I didn't. I wasn't involved in any other activity other than kind of Saigon with Air Force types and Navy guy. I told you about with the elephants.
Okay. That's okay. Now let me ask about your flights where you were actually taking some ground fire. You hadn't flown under fire, you know, since really, am I right, World War II?
That's correct.
Was that a little scary?
Well, yeah.
I mean, it had to have been.
When you hear something ping on your on your wing or somewhere, it wasn't heavy fire. It's
sure.
Rifle. Mm-hmm. Maybe a .22, I don't know. Mm-hmm. What size? Well, yeah, some of it got as high as 30 caliber, but no 50 caliber type. It was just locals. It wasn't just so-called insurgents down there.
Right, okay.
But it was enough. If we got fired, if we could verify it, we got fired on, it was called a combat mission.
Okay.
So,
am I right? I think your notes told us that you had about 35 of those?
I have 55 total, including the ones that I flew with the FACs.
Okay.
The total.
55, you're right, combat missions.
Now, one mistake in that, though, uh-huh. I did say in my next tour, I said 100, I had 100
yeah.
missions.
Uh-huh.
But I goofed, it's 96.
Oh, 96, well, okay, this is in the notes that he's provided to us, so I'll just make a little note there that you exaggerated by 4 missions. Were you able to keep your hours up such that all your flying certifications, mm-hmm. no problems there?
No problem.
Okay, and Jim, just while I'm thinking about it, I just want to enter into the record. What was, at the time of retirement, your total number of flying hours with the U.S. Air Force?
11,034.
That's just amazing. That's to me just amazing.
That's why I say I have a unique career. I had all these staff jobs, did all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And normally, a colonel with 28 years or 30 years, 5,000, 7,000 maybe, something like that.
It's absolutely.
I was a hog.
It's astounding. Yeah, there's a lot of jet fuel down the
drain.
He loves to fly. Do you still fly at all? When was the last time you flew?
Myself?
Yes.
Oh, probably 1976 or 77.
So you haven't flown since then? You miss it?
I did for a while.
Yeah, not so much anymore. You're too busy. You got too many other things going on.
Shortly after I retired, about a month or two, I guess, moved to Granbury. We went out to the air base at Carswell. And she looked around. She says, "Do you miss all this?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "No, not really. I loved it. Every day I was in it, even combat. But I don't miss it a bit."
He forgot the colonel part. He
yeah,
was just
I said, everybody I met, I said, "Nope." If they say Colonel Hall, Colonel Jim, nope, I'm just Jim. I still say that.
Some of our friends are still Colonel and Mrs. Colonel.
Mrs.
Oh,
right.
Boy, Mrs. Major Hall.
I never did feel that.
That's one of the contradictions I always felt was terrible in the Air Force. Wives trying to wear their husband's rank.
He told me I don't have any rank. I'm a
But I'm a base commander. People come to her. Anyway, how about getting Jim to such and such? I'm sorry, I don't work for Jim.
I said, I don't have any rank.
Good for you. Good for you. I don't report to him. That's good for you. Well, let's take a break for a sec.
Okay.